Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
Keith.
Most important thing I can share with you is it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any drugs since May 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm certainly glad to be here and glad to be sober. Thank you for inviting me, committee, what have you, and good to be here with all the legends and old-timers, John. I had the privilege of eating dinner with John over to Athens or somewhere. Athens, yeah. That guy knows something about everything. I mean, you need to know anything, yes, John. He knows. He was fun. I needed to laugh, too. Anyhow, good to be here. And Larry, I doubt if you guys know that Larry used to be a cop. Down in Long Beach, he was a cop for a short period of time. They found out he's dyslexic because he kept giving IUDs instead of DUIs. Well, I tell you, man, you get going around doing these things, you get to meet them all. They send the sickest ones to get you, thinking maybe you can help them. You know, like you got, if you're coming to talk, you got a magic wand. You can straighten them out, you know. Oh, man, I'm telling you. And then they send a limousine to pick you up and take you back to the airport in a Jeep, you know. You know, so you got to be sure and get it arranged to get out. Good to see my friend Honest John over there. I know all of them. And Cease and all these guys here. We've been around doing things. I sobered up when I was 36 years old, and the miracle is I have gradually turned into an adult. It's taken a while. I'm almost 63 now, 36 to 63. That's long enough to make a change out of puberty, you know, whatever. My wife's in Al-Anon. She's over in St. Louis doing some things this weekend. We've been together 44 years, and that's because she doesn't believe in divorce. Homicide, but no divorce. I got a daughter that's 39 years old and a granddaughter that's 4 years old, and I'm truly blessed. This month, within 9 days, I'll have 27 years of sobriety. That's close enough to, I'm close enough to it that I think there's a chance I'll make it. There's some people betting on me, but, you know, I've been here long enough to outlive most of my critics and most of my resentments, too, for that matter. So I'm good to go. I was born in Texas, and that doesn't necessarily make you an alcoholic. It's a disease of its own, and that's a good place to be from. My family, I got family still there. My mother-in-law lives out there, and she's a dog catcher. And they had a little community, and she's, one of the regulars there. My wife's from Kansas, Pratt, Kansas. She was born in Pratt, Kansas, you know. So that's kind of, where I came up from. I'm at least a fifth-generation alcoholic. My daddy's an alcoholic. His daddy's an alcoholic. His daddy's an alcoholic, and so on and so forth. That isn't anything to brag about anywhere but in AA, I guess. My daddy is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He sobered up when he was 62 years old. He drank till he was 62. He's a lawyer, you know, and they're too smart to be an alcoholic, you know. But he sobered up. He's got 25 years of sobriety. I got 14 months of seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget it. 87 years old, that old turkey. He's still alive, still goes to his meetings, and, he's just my dad. But all my, all the character defects of all of my family kind of rolled on down into me. That's the main thing. It didn't make me an alcoholic, but made me pretty. I had some insight on things, I'll guarantee you. And growing up in an alcoholic home don't make you an alcoholic, but if you're a budding alcoholic, it helps if you do grow up in an alcoholic home because there's a lot of alcohol there. And you need that. You need that. I started drinking at a very early age, and I liked it. It did exactly for me what alcohol is supposed to do. I'm I'm grateful for it. I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't had alcohol. I also had some other problems. My uncle was a doctor, and one of them old family doctors made house calls, and he had that little black case, and he'd come over there, and anytime I got out of line, well, he'd come over there and take that syringe out and draw something out of one of them little bottles and shoot me in the butt with it. Straightened me right out, you know. And so, you know, I didn't, when I crossed over that line and went right on into bigger and better things, well, I wasn't a problem. And I was doing all that stuff at an early age. By the time I was 12 and a half years old, I was in trouble because of alcohol. And in the area where I grew up, why, when I was in trouble there, why, my mother died when I was born, and my daddy had gone off to the Second World War, and I was just running loose, and I started getting in a lot of trouble. I grew up in a farming community, so I could drive when I was 12 years old. I had a license, a farm permit. I had my own car when I was 12 years old. I could drive, and my family, my folks' family, was upper middle class. I didn't want for anything. They had all enough money to get us in trouble and a lot of money to get us out of trouble. And one of my biggest recollections of fear was coming to in a jail cell, and my lawyer was in there with me. And that was my dad. I said, "How are you going to represent me? You're in here drunk." He said, "Oh, don't worry. I know the judge, you know." And knew I was going to have to get a new lawyer there. But, you know, I when I was 12 and a half years old, why, they locked me up with a bunch of other problem kids. And I didn't have any, you know, fancy names for it other than just a, you know, home for wayward kids. The girls were over on one side of town and the boys were over on the other side of the town, and had barbed wire around it. And I did equivalent to high school. In that place, they had school, they had sports, they had things, you know, but you couldn't leave. And I learned a lot of things in there from guys just like me, guys from broken homes. And they had a lot of kids come in from all over the country, and they had a lot of new ideas, a lot of things, exciting things to do, you know, and ways to do them. And I was a quick study, and I picked right up on things. I really never did stop to wonder what it was going to do to me or how it was going to happen or what. I just did it. I like the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. Deal me in. I like the deal. And I got out of there when I was equivalent to a senior in high school. I don't know, probably 16 and a half, 17 years old. I went home, and my grandmother told me it doesn't take any more effort to marry a rich woman than it does to marry a poor woman. She just didn't tell me it takes more effort to keep one. But I met this little gal. Her daddy was a very, very wealthy man, and had lots and lots and lots. He had enough money for me and him both. I could tell that real quick. And we met and got married, and I sweet-talked her, and we got married, and they started giving us money to... supposed to go to school. I'm one of them guys that went to school. I don't like work. I really don't like work. I can watch you do it all day long. But I went to school from the time I started the first grade till the time I quit going to school was 21 years, and I never learned anything, but I know where to find it if you need it. Ask John. He knows. See? But my father-in-law gave us, $5,000-$6,000 a month back in 1958, 59. That was a lot of money. You buy a lot of stuff to go to school. And my wife and I were going to school down in near Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. And that wasn't enough money for me. That was not enough money for me. I was really flying low. And I started enhancing my income by selling some non-habit forming marijuana. I wasn't smoking it. I was selling it. And to the students, you know. I'd sell them a joint or a test, you know, last year's test, you know. Tell them it was this year's test, you know. And football players like that especially, you know. They're practicing, working out. They don't have time to study. But you got to leave right before finals. You need to leave town. And anyway, I was on my way out of there, and I got in a little car wreck, and there was some burlap bags in the back of the car I was driving. It had some marijuana residue in it, and, you know, down in Texas back then, you got 25 years for having a joint, man. I mean, I used to laugh at that. I thought, you know, I'm not even going to live that long. Why would you want to give me that kind of a sentence? But, you know, I didn't care. Well, anyway, I was in jail. My father-in-law come to see me, and he said, I got a lot of money. And I thought, well, he's going to get me out. And he said, you know what? The reason I have a lot of money is because I don't make bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And I started that long series of abandonment issues. Man. I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but I'll tell you, when people are leaving you all the time, why, that's an abandonment issue. And they left me down there, and I had to do a little time down Huntsville. And, I can adjust. I just adjust. It don't make any difference. I never thought, you know, anything about it other than just whatever. And, I did that. I didn't go to any AA or any self-help programs. You know, the funny thing about it is, only in AA. I was in Huntsville in the penitentiary, and the guy that was the warden is a non-alcoholic trustee in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know who I'm talking about? Right. I've been on the same program with him. The warden that was the warden of the prison I was in has been on the same. He was a non-alcoholic trustee for AA, and we talked at a H&I convention. Only in AA that would happen. See? And I didn't have any resentments against him. I mean, he didn't know me. I was one of many, but, you know, full circle. And anyway, I got out of there, and I went home, and I called up my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and they come to meet me at the train station in Amarillo, Texas. They gave me $100 and a suit, and I got some whiskey and got on the train. Started looking back over my life and kind of did a little four-step thing, you know. What I got to do and what I can't do. I got to stay out of them honky-tonks, stay away from them crazy women, and stay out of them fast cars. And I got out of the train station there in Amarillo, Texas, and Oil and Goose have been there a couple of 3 days. They're drunk. And they've been listening to Del Rio, Texas, Wolfman Jack on the radio and Run the Battery Down. And drinking White Lightning and had a jar of Benny's. And we got a push start, and I took a big old shot of that White Lightning. You know, I just, oh, that stuff. I mean, the anticipation of what that's going to do is just so exciting. And it didn't have no foo-foos or umbrellas in it either, I'll guarantee you, man. And we went down to country dance down there on Saturday night, and we got in there at midnight, and the band had taken an intermission, and so I started to fight. And I like to start fights. I just don't like to stick around until they're over, thank you. But I started to fight, and it got out of control, and I ducked in a woman's restroom, and there's a lady standing next to the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I hid out, and pretty soon she stuck her head in there and said, you can come out now, cowboy. And I came out. Band was playing. She was handy. I asked her for a dance, and I'm quick study. Found out she had a job, car, money in the bank, place to stay, you know, driver's license, none of which did I have. And I fell in love with her. Yeah. And that was 44 years ago, and we're still together. We're still dancing the last dance, baby, I'll guarantee you. I found out she finished the fight I started, too. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Sick attracts sick. I love it. People come in here in AA and they're going to hook up. You know, it's like going to a mud hole to get a drink of water. You know what I mean? Yeah. But, you know, we dated for 2 weeks and they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. You know, it was just so much pain, it had to be love. That's all. Yeah. And a couple of years went by, and she, you know, said she's pregnant, and I was the father, and I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when that happened, but I don't know. But anyhow, we did our thing. We got married, and got married in Amarillo, Texas, and drunk preacher. Preacher was drunk. I got him drunk, and got married in his kitchen. And wife was peeling onions, and everybody's crying. Yeah. Classic, drunk, you know, get married, her mother was there with her new boyfriend, you know. And we went back to our little apartment, and, you know, I just started, we had a little girl. Life, my drinking just got worse and worse and worse. My drinking got worse and worse, and my drinking never got better. It got worse, and then it got worser. And I can look back on my life and see where it took $50 for me to get out of trouble. See? $50 to get in trouble. And I can remember when it took $5,000 to get out, you know? And I'm one of them guys, I never borrowed a car from anybody but what I didn't wreck it, you know? And I wrecked a lot of cars, didn't even know who they belonged to. Nothing personal, you know. I just got in a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. And we ended up having to leave country, you know, leave town. And I'd had a friend named Lion Shorty, and he told me I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, California. And that's ocean, you know, so a guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? Huh? Anyway, I took off, loaded my family up in this old station wagon, put stuff in a trailer. It looks like the grapes of wrath. We take off. I'm drunk and got the wife and daughter and the dog. Had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog named Shaft. My wife said, if I ever leave you, the only thing you're getting is a dog. Yeah. And we took off for California. It took us a month to get there. Anybody else could have made the trip in 3 or 4 days, you know, just because I was lost a lot. She said, why don't you pull over and ask somebody where we are? I said, then they'd know I'm lost. I don't want anybody to know I'm lost. Hell. So we took off. We got there, and I got a drunken uncle. He found me a place to live, and we moved into this place. And a bunch of crazy people all around the neighborhood. And God, I got a good deal on it. I like a deal. You know, I got a good deal on a house. Nobody lived in it in a couple of years. And a bunch of hippies lived next door to me, you know. I never seen nothing like that before, I'll tell you. Them are weird people. That's back in the flower child days, you know. They was dropping acid, taking their clothes off, legging naked in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down, you know. My old car didn't have a reverse. I'd have to drive through their driveway and cross their front yard and pull up, you know, so you could leave. You had to be careful you didn't run over one of them hippies laying out there, you know. Motorcycle gang on the other side of me, you know, just wild and crazy bunch. And I took up a little residency there, got my wife, daughter in there in this house, and I'd take off and do my thing. I'm one of them kind of guys that brings people home with me, you know, my friends, all of them. The guys that don't want to go home and fight with their wife, they come over to my house and watch me fight with mine. You know them guys? They stand behind you and say, get her. She's carrying a 12-inch butcher knife. I said, step to the head of the line, Ace, you know. I like guns myself. Guns will enhance conversation. I like guns that have a big barrel. I'm a gun runner. I got a gun. Your ass better run, I'll tell you. And I'd stick that gun right on her nose, man. It looked like this donut right on her nose. And she'd stick that knife right in my stomach, and she'd say, you go first. I said, you're crazy. If I shoot you, you'll die. She said, I know, but the momentum will knock me back. My arm will go out, and you'll die too. You know, sick women don't have train for that. They don't need to go through the Marine training course for killing wise asses. I'll tell you, they just know it immediately. Yeah. But it's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob. I'd come home, open that door, there she was. Yeah, she knew more about where I'd been than I did. I don't like to talk to anybody that knows more about where I've been than me, you know? Always pouring my booze out, filling it. I drank a lot of vodka because you can't smell it. She'd fill it up with water. I poured a guy a big old glass of vodka one time, opened that quart of vodka up and poured him a big glass, and he drank it all down. And he said, man, he said, I'm either the meanest sucker in town or that's the smoothest vodka I ever had. I knew she'd fill that with water, see? Yeah. And always something going on. I'd come home, I'd try to, you know, do my civic duty and mow my yard. I didn't have a yard. I had front dirt, you know. And I didn't have a very good maintenance program on my lawnmower or nothing. You know, all that stuff's out in the garage. I'm going to fix it someday, you know. But I'd get up in the morning, I'd go out in the kitchen, and I'd put me a handful of mini bennies in the blender, pour some orange juice, a couple of 3 eggs in there, throw the shell and all, you know. A little breakfast of champions, you know. And drink that down real quick and then pour me a nice fruit jar size glass of tequila or vodka and hit it a couple times with some Tabasco sauce. So you call it a Bloody Mary. I would have an intuitive idea immediately. I think I'll mow my front yard. And I'd go out in the garage and get my lawnmower out there. It's out there somewhere. It's like a spiritual experience to find your lawnmower. Well, there it is. Hey, didn't have no grass catcher. Didn't need no grass catcher. Find a pull rope while you lucky, you know. You get a load on like I had. I usually push started my lawnmower. You know. I'd be out there at 4 o'clock in the morning mowing my front dirt, slinging weeds and stuff everywhere, you know. The Christians over on the other side of the street have them dichondra lawns. That guy'd come out and stand on the curb and a little vein in his forehead would just pulsate. I'm throwing weeds and stuff everywhere. When my mower died, must have been something about horses I learned, because horse breaks its leg, you got to shoot it. So I blowed my lawnmower up with a 44 mag. About 5 o'clock one morning, the cops came, ran my head into their nightstick out there, you know. Take me down, put me in jail. She's got to come down, write a hot check and get me out, because that's her job. And I go back, and what, you know, what goes up's got to come down. I had me an old recliner. I'd laid back in my recliner. I like to drop a few reds and drink some Red Mountain wine. That makes you feel good. Kind of takes you out of your problem. And I'd lay in that old recliner. My granddaddy had an old Winchester 97 shotgun sawed off, and I'd drag it out from underneath that chair, and I'd jack her back and stick a barrel in my mouth. Her and a few of the neighbor ladies, you know, the line up on the line of contempt. The line of contempt on the other side of the room where they're looking at you, sorry, no good, you know. I'd stick the barrel of that shotgun in my mouth and click the trigger. It's empty, of course. Didn't want to commit suicide until I got a big crowd. One time I jacked it back, seen something red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. You know, I pulled over and clicked the trigger, blew the air conditioner right out of the wall. That one put a shell in that gun, tried to kill me. Couldn't hear out of the ear for a month. If my neighbor would have been over there to kill him, you know, cops come, run my head in their nightstick 4 or 5 times, take me down, put me in jail. She's got to come down, write a hot check, and get me out. And, I found myself standing in front of the judge. Judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy. And, I didn't know what I was in there for, because I ate my booking slip, and, didn't want to worry all weekend. And, so, he had the deal. And somewhere during the deal, I didn't know the judge. He'd gone to AA. He needed to. He's bad. But he started them court card things. And so this guy said, well, should send you to the penitentiary. You're going to parole you. But you're going to have to go to some A&A meetings. Now, I didn't know what A&A was. I'd been doing B&B. See? But I owed some guys in jail money, and I didn't want to go there. And so I said, all right, I'll do it, whatever it is. And so they had this guy, Ivan Miller. Ivan Miller was about so tall. His eyes drooped. He's sober 25 years. His knuckles drug the ground. He was an old machinist. His hands were all greasy and rough. And drove an old beat-up pickup truck. And Ivan would come and get you if the judge, you know, let you go to AA with a court card. Ivan picked you up. He looked like he's drunk that day, you know. And Ivan picked me up. Took me out in the truck and drove me around, showed me where there's some A&A meetings. All right. Took me home. I'd been in a fight. And I'd been to the point of a fight, matter of fact. And a guy hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench. And I ducked just in time, but it almost tore my ear off. And so I had this bandage on my head with this big old blood-soaked ear muff on. And had no underwear on, no socks, traveling pretty light. And Ivan took me around. I had long, long beard and long hair, and no ID. No ID. I always like, when you go to jail, no ID. Throw everything away. They see me last weekend, but I don't want them to know who I am. And, so anyway, I go home, lay down on the couch, and my wife going to see a new lawyer, and he said I should go to A&A. And so she comes in with a new idea. Said, I know what it is. You need to go to AA. I let her think it was her idea. I didn't want her to know I had a court card. So, all right, she said, I have a meeting over here. Starts at 8:30, it's over at 10. I laid there on that old vinyl couch till my head stuck to it, my earmuffs stuck to the couch. About 8 o'clock, she come in there with that butcher knife and said, well, get up. I said, where are we going? She said, we need to go to A&A. All right, peel me off the couch and I'm going to go to my first A&A meeting. Now, I'm going to tell you something. My house is painted in 4 different colors because I lost interest easy. You know, had good intentions, but I lost interest easy. Our family wagon was a Pinto, kind of a baby poop brown Pinto. No reverse, hole in the muffler, went down the road crooked. The window on the driver's side was half down, half up, whatever. My wife wore them beehive hairdos where they put about a can and a half of spray net in it. And the wind sucked her hair out the window all the time, so she... My kid looked like a wounded animal, had hair in her face, wore old coat, all crumpled up. My dog had chewed all the hair off his body everywhere he could mouth the roof. Looked like a laughing hyena. He had a twitch and a snarl. He chewed the hair off his tail and all them little places in there. The cat had a permanent puff tail, just ran screeching around the house all the time. And I had this blood-soaked earmuff, and we'd go out and get in the Pinto to go to my first AA meeting. The inside of that Pinto, the dog always licked the windows and had cat hair all over it, you know, and everything. And we load in that old Pinto to go to the AA meeting, pull up in front of a church, got a big AA sign out in front of the door, pull up one door in, one door out. I seen that. I looked in the room, a bunch of people in their AAs, and my first thought was, well, I've sunk to the bottom now. Now, let me tell you, that's low bottom snobbery, baby, when you're coming from where the house we left and you pull up in front of recovery and you've gone to the... If my friends see me going in here, they'll never have nothing to do with me again. You know? My wife must have anticipated my approach avoidance there because she whipped that butcher knife up in my mouth and said, let me tell you something, Ace, that meeting over at 10:30, if you come out of that house, you come out of that room before 10:30, I'm going to gut you. You can keep me in an AA meeting like that if you got a crazy woman circling the perimeter with a 12-inch butcher knife. I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. I ain't leaving that room. I did that one time. I passed out on her 15 minutes into a two-hour conversation. She stabbed me all over my back, right through my shirt. When I came to, I said, something's wrong with my back. She said, oh, let me see. You know, act like she didn't know. Said, you broke out of at knee of the back. You're drinking that rot gut whiskey, and she poured rubbing alcohol all over me. You know? That got me closer to Jesus than anything the Baptist ever did. So I'm telling you, I went in there. I mean, I went in there, I looked around. You know, I wouldn't have drank with nobody in that room, much less sell them weed, you know. And I looked, counted all the squares and all the lights. Light bulbs was out. I knew the old-timers because they got hair growing out of their ears. That's experience. See? I knew that. I didn't hear nothing. Nothing. I went to that meeting once a week for 4 months. And I went home, stayed at home, hid out. Amazing thing. I didn't hear anything. I didn't do anything. I was as dry as a fire hazard. I'm telling you, I didn't do nothing. Nobody, but I'll tell you something. Nobody asked me if I needed anything. Nobody offered me a book or any literature. Nobody said hi to me. They could see I had a sponsor. She's waiting right outside the door. Yeah. Beat the deal down at the courthouse. I know a couple of things as a result of that. There's people come to Alcoholics Anonymous to change the conditions in their life, and there's people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous to change their life. And the only reason I was going is to change the conditions in my life, and I can guarantee you the conditions changed. And they'll even change even if you don't sober up. Beat the deal at the courthouse. I was back in the big bedroom. I was sitting on the couch. The old dog's laying next to me. I pat him on the head. The cat's in my lap purring. The kid's over here. She's in the kitchen fixing a meal, and I thought to myself, self, yeah, prematurely gone to AA. Yeah. I know I'll be there someday, but I'll be old like John. It'll all be over. Hell, you know? So I resigned. I went by the meeting over there and told them bye. I was going to go to B&B. I got drunk immediately because I wanted to drink. When I wanted to drink, I drank. I got drunk. I don't remember anything that they said in that AA. I went back to AA for the next 4 or 5 years, in and out. Sometimes I'd come drunk. Sometimes I'd come sober. Went to one of them alcathons where they have meetings all around the clock. Got drunk and sober 4 times in one day. Right in AA. I never caused no trouble or nothing. I don't remember anything. I try to remember something I heard when I went there that 4 months. One old guy said, we won't guarantee you after tonight you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you'll never enjoy another one. I remember him. I tried to find him and run over him. Nothing worse than having a head full of AA and a belly full of booze, I'm telling you. I mean, you really are a loser, and you know it. And I'd go to meetings. I came out of a blackout one time. I was down in Laguna. I didn't leave the meeting because I didn't know who brought me. I wasn't sure what had followed me out. I mean, it's miserable. Miserable. And I'd go, and I'd try to sober up. I remember I went to the National Council of Alcoholism. My wife, they had someone on the radio and said, the National Council of Alcoholism. And I remember I went over there. We took a bus, and we rode over to the National Council of Alcoholism. It was Monday. I just got out of jail. I was hungover. And we went in and had an appointment, and this guy said, National Council of Alcoholism. I thought, I'm going straight to the top. Hey. And the guy said, I don't know if we can help you or not. He said something about antabuse and stuff. You know, you got to take antabuse. Because I said, I can't stay sober. I try. I go to AA, and I can't stay sober. And he said, but we can't just give you that. You got to go see a doctor and everything else. I remember we got up, my wife and I got up, and we walked out that office and leaned up against the wall out in front of that National Council of Alcoholism. Leaned up out there, and I remember looking at her saying, well, that ain't going to work. No, that won't work. I don't know what we're going to do. I got drunk immediately. I remember one time, it was Monday afternoon, I got out of jail, and my wife was there to pick me up with some guy, and they took me over to Alano Club, one of them. California have them Alano clubs where they have meetings and stuff, but it's open. They have a coffee bar. I remember when we went in there about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there's three or four old bums sitting in there because there wasn't no meetings going on. They just sitting in there, street guys, you know, and sitting on the couch. And I go in and there's a guy serving coffee, and he's shaking, you know. And I get a cup of coffee, and my wife gets a cup of coffee, and we go sit down, and I look around in there. There wasn't no meeting going on. Nothing was going on. Nothing's happening. There's old bums sitting in there. Sit there a little while. We got up, walked outside, and I remember looking at my wife saying, well, that's it. That's AA. See? Nobody can't stay sober like that, you know. And she'd look at me and she'd say, yeah, I really don't know, you know. She'd take me to them meetings. They'd have an Al-Anon meeting right next door, but there wasn't nothing wrong with her. See? There wasn't nothing wrong with her. And for the next 4 years, I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would hear good stuff. Hear people say, you know, you've got to cease fighting everything and everybody. And so I would go home from that meeting. I'd run around in the house, and I'd say, I got to cease fighting everything and everybody. And she'd take one step closer and get that finger going right in my nose. Say, if you don't do this, you don't do that. I said, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. She'd take one step closer. And I said, if you don't get out of my face, I'm going to hit you. And she'd take one step closer. Bam! I'd hit her, and the fight was on. We'd be fighting out in the front yard and all down, and I'd be off someplace drunk. I come back home, sober up, go to AA meeting. I go in there and honk and sniff on the girls. I go home and say, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. She'd say, you haven't made love to me in years, you stinking old drunk. And then we'd have a big discussion over who was whose lower companion, you know. And then I'd say, the heck with you, woman, and I'd be off down Long Beach with a hooker getting drunk again. I'd come home and I'd sober up. And I'd go in there and she'd say, I need money. I said, no problem, I'll give you a check. Well, now, I'm the kind of guy who puts $100 in 8 different banks and writes $8,000 worth of checks, see? She went to jail because of my check. So the minute I said, I'll give you a check, bam, the fight's on. Then I'm gone, went somewhere, wrote a hot check, and got drunk again, see? And what I know today is I can't get sober in a place I drank in. And I can't stay sober in a drunk house. See, that's just me. I don't know about anybody else. But I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went home to a crazy, drunken home. And the same old patterns, nothing was changing in home, see. And I heard the answer in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I went back to this insane household and the insane environment that I was drinking in, and I couldn't stay sober. Nobody gave me a phone number all those years. Nobody gave me a ride home. I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's supposed to come and get me or something. Sometimes the meeting would be over at 9:30, and she'd think it's over at 10. And everybody would leave the meeting. I'd be sitting outside drunk. Sitting on the curb or on the stairs. Nobody said, you want to ride home or anything. I guess they figure I'm drunk, I'm not going to sober up, whatever. But, you know, from that I know there's meetings you can go to and nobody will say anything to you. I don't do that. And because of the way I went for years and nobody talked to me, well, I'll talk to them. I'll guarantee you. And the people I sponsor do too. But don't leave nobody sitting around and not talk to them. But I learned that. Nobody talked to me. I didn't know anything. I had one last deal. One last big deal. I owed a lot of money. And so I had a little thing. I bought that house I lived in for $20,000. I owed $140 on it. That's hard to do in California. But I borrowed all that money on it to stay out of, you know, lawyers, bondsmen, stuff. And one last deal, these guys offered me an opportunity to haul a load of cocaine up the coast and deliver it for some money. And so I got this vehicle, and I took off. And I stopped, and I got me a quart of whiskey. I drank a half quart of whiskey, and then had a good idea. I think I'll steal the coke. And so I pulled off, and I hid the coke. Then I drank the rest of the whiskey and forgot where I hid the coke. So that's how I know I'm an alcoholic, not an addict. Shortly thereafter, I sobered up enough to know that I was in trouble because I couldn't remember where I hid the stuff. That was big trouble. So I went and hid out. And I was in January 1976, and I went to this little town. It had previously been a military town, and they had some old barracks there and stuff. You can get a room for $50 a year. And I got me a good room over there. Not because I was cheap, just because I wasn't going to be there long. And I stayed in there from January of 1976 until right before in May, first part of May of 1976, drunk, sober, loaded all the time, people bringing me stuff, whatever, just couldn't get sober, couldn't get drunk, just hiding out, crazy, paranoid, barking at the moon type, just, you know, crawling around, elbows, my knees, just frothing around in a mattress and just didn't eat nothing. Just sick, sick, sick. Couldn't get, you know, I mean, it's like I've been to AA, I've been to National Council of Alcoholism, I've been to penitentiaries, I've had psychiatrists. I did Zen Buddhism, but I wasn't sober, so it didn't take. And I tried everything, shock treatments. I'd done everything. I'd had all kinds of psychiatric help and locked up jails. I've been baptized so many times I look like a prune. My daughter said, Daddy, don't make me go down there with you again, please. Look at my hands. They're all turned crunky, you know. And I couldn't get sober. I finally crawled out of that place, and I went back in the area where my family was. They ran away, and I started calling Alcoholics Anonymous again. Because if you don't die, you're going to have to go back to AA. That's it. You can go get drunk all you want, but if you don't die, eventually you're going to have to go back to AA, you know, sooner or later. And it took a few days. My dad was sober at the time for a little while there, and he was trying to get me a call and get people to come and get me. And the funny thing, there was two guys. They had two central offices. They had two guys that manned the phone at the central office. Now, they knew me. They wouldn't get nobody would come and 12-step me. I always had guns. I was always shooting up the place, and nobody would go. There was a guy named Wheelchair Jack was on the phone at the central office. Wheelchair Jack was a Marine fighter pilot, and he crashed, and he was crippled. And he was in a wheelchair, and he was an alcoholic, and he's sober probably 12 years at the time. And he manned the phone at the central office. There was another guy named Jack Callahan. Little Jack was a Marine fighter pilot. He crashed, and he walked away from his crash. He was pretty tore up, but him and Jack, both alcoholics, used to laugh about, you know, who could walk away from their plane crash, you know, and what have you. So Wheelchair Jack was on the phones down at the central office, and they'd been trying to get somebody 12-step me, and he was always playing jokes on his buddy, Jack, Little Jack. So he called Little Jack and said, you know what, we got this high roller over here in the big house, which was a lie, but he said, if you go 12-step this guy, why, it's really going to be a feather in your hat. And he tricked Little Jack to come to my house. And Little Jack had been working all day, hadn't had anything to eat. He went by himself. He came to my house, and he knocked on the front door. The front door wasn't attached. It was kind of set there. Anyway, I opened the door and stuck a .357 Magnum right in his face because they'd come and get me and take me to the nut ward, see, lock me up. I said, if you're going to take me back to the nut ward, I'm going to kill you. And he did something he's never done since. He grabbed that gun right out of my hand, threw that old door aside, threw that gun in there, and pushed me backwards until I landed on a couch. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I'm a fortunate guy. I'm sober almost 27 years. And the guy that 12-stepped me is still alive. John's met him. He's still alive. I can't lie about how cool I was when I sobered up. See? He knows. Every Tuesday I call him. And he says, where are you talking next? And I tell him, well, I'm going down here in Marietta, Georgia. He says, be sure and tell them folks down there you wouldn't have nothing to say if it weren't for me. Right? See, that guy keeps me straight and honest, man. He's seen me when I was my best. And he loaded me up. He got my wife to go, told my daughter to stay in the house. And he took me around. It took 4 hours to get somebody to take me in. 4 hours. Nobody wanted me. And finally, there was a brand new treatment center opened up. And Dr. Paul Olliger, page 449 in the real book, he was a doctor there, and a guy named Dr. Zuschka. Dr. Zuschka was instrumental in starting all the military treatment centers out there for all the armed services, a non-alcoholic. And they had just started a treatment center that lasted, it was a minimum of a month, 2 months. And Dr. Paul was assigned to be my doctor. When a student is ready, the teacher will appear. And man, I could not put nothing over Dr. Paul. I'm telling you, that dude was so smart. He had 2 doctor's degrees, and he was an alcoholic to boot. And his wife was an Al-Anon. And he was my doctor. And I stayed in there, and Dr. Paul would, after I was sober a little while, I mean, I tell you, I detoxed. I'd take 3 steps and laugh, 3 steps and cry. I threw up till my toes come out my nose, you know. And I kicked, and I'm telling you, there's been times when I wanted to stay to hell with it, and then I'd think, I don't want to detox again. I mean, they detoxed me. They give me nothing. I said, how about them other people? They get hard candy. They said, no, have a banana. Give me bananas. You know, you need potassium. What they said was, put that banana in your mouth and shut up. And wouldn't give me no Valium or nothing, you know. And I just kicked. 11 days sober, I kicked again. Just sick. And they just walked me. And I wanted to drink all the time. I'm not one of them alcoholics that had any boom and it went away, baby. I wanted to drink all the time. I wanted to drink. I'd been loaded so long that stuff was in my system. And Dr. Paul used to load me up and take me to meetings. Take me out in his car, 2 or 3 of us, and we'd go to meetings. And I'm so grateful that there's, you know, I can see so far today because I've stood on the shoulders of giants, baby. I've had great teachers, and some of them taught me what not to do, but Dr. Paul was there for me, and he didn't put up with any of my crap. And I stayed in there 2 months or so, and on the last day I was in there, I had to have a sponsor to get out, and I already had one. And there was 39 of us in the graduating class of that 2 months, and they put us in a circle, and they let everybody take each other's inventory. And they started right on my left, went right around. Zip. God has a funny sense of humor. And everybody in that circle said I was going to get loaded when I got out because I wanted to get loaded all the time. Everybody. 38 people said, Keith's a good old boy, but he's going to get loaded. They were so sure I was going to get drunk that I almost voted with them. You know? But there was a pilot light 2 inches behind my belly button, the desire to make it. And that's why I always say I'm sober today. Because loving God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and a little effort on my own. John Carlton taught me that. A little effort on my own, baby, and there better be a little effort on your own. Because I'm going to tell you something. I'm the only one out of 39 that's still sober. And over half of them committed suicide. And a bunch of them did it sober. See? So screw the vote. And this is not a popularity contest around here. I didn't come here to get popular. I came here to get sober. And I stayed sober the first year and a half purely on a resentment. You know, just purely on a resentment. Simply because 38 people said I was going to drink, and I just showed them. On 1 year, there was only 11 out of 39 that could take a 1 year cake. See? And I remember I was hiding out because I had things to do. Okay, so the book says when you stop, waves of the past roll over you. Oh, I had some big waves rolling over me. I was 52 days sober and remember where I hid the dope. And I had to give that back to those people. I didn't ask some smart ass if I should flush it. I said, this is your stuff. There it is. And I left it alone. And I share that simply because there's a part in the big book that says your enemies will welcome you. I would be careful of that. I owed over $250,000 to people you can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. I'd bought that house for owed $120 on it. And I didn't do anything to my house for 3 years. Left it just like it was. I would go to a meeting, and I would sit in a meeting, and I'd look around. I'm in AA. Then I'd go home, and I'd sit in that house. It had holes in the walls, everything. And I would look around, and I'd say, yeah, that was me. I did this. See? And my wife went to Al-Anon, and the kid went to Al-Teen, the dog went to Al-Dog, and the cat went to Al-Cat. And they released my ass. I mean, released me. The AA. I had a sponsor, Rotten Ron. I'm one of them fortunate guys. My first sponsor sits right next to me every Thursday night. He knows me. He won't let me lie about how slick I was when I got here, see? And I went to meetings and meetings and meetings. I was crazy. I'd sit in a chair and just move it around. It just moved around. I wouldn't drink all the time. I had people after me. I said, I tell you what, if I get what I deserve, you better not be sitting next to me, baby, because it's going to splatter all over you. And I owed money. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and Ron said, I'm tired of you whining about owing these people money. Go tell them you're sober and pay them back. You're going to pay them back. I said, what? I said, yeah. There's a guy over in Whittier, a little town over there, about 10 miles. He said, we got about an hour before the next meeting. He said, you go over to Whittier and tell that guy where you're in AA, you're sober, you're going to pay him back. I said, he wants to kill me. He said, I don't care. Go do it. I went over and ran up the door, knocked on the door. Guy came to the door, his eyes that big around, all coked up, had a gun in each hand. I said, I'm in AA. I'm going to pay back. Don't worry. And I turned around and ran like hell back to my car. Got in my car, went back over to the meeting hall. The sponsor was sitting there. He said, I thought I told you to go to Whittier. I said, I did. He said, you did? And I said, yeah. He said, he didn't kill you? I said, no. He said, I'll be damned. See, then I figured it out. They send you out to try it, and if it works, they'll do it. I got it now. See? Yeah. And, man, I had to pay. It took me 14 years to pay back that money. And I didn't have an overwhelming good feeling about it either, I'll tell you. Because I had nothing to show for it. I don't mind. I come out of a blackout driving a brand new Mercedes that I bought with no credit. And I was sitting in front of an AA meeting. Now, I can brag about that and go out and get my car and drive it off. But when I sobered up in May of 76, I didn't have nothing to show for it. See? Nothing. I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. See? And I got to pay this money back. And I didn't do it because I'm a good guy. I did it because I didn't want to drink. I had to pay these people back. I went to this guy whose folks had a lot of money, and he inherited the bank and everything, and I went to see him, and I said, got a lot of money, need to borrow a lot of money from you. I'm sober. He said, I heard. I said, well, I need some money, about $250,000. He threw a checkbook across the deal and the pen. He said, start writing checks when you're done. Let me know. We'll set up a payment plan. So, thank you. He said, remember that day down in the park when we was about 5 or 6 years old and you pulled my pants down in front of the girls? Yeah. He said, I ain't never forgotten that. And he said, I'll tell you something. I'm going to loan you this money, and if you miss one payment, I'm going to have you killed. And he could do it, too. Well, hey, you give an alcoholic that kind of a deal, an option, I'll take it. I took the checkbook and the pen, and I left. You know, and I remember the last payment. I was 14 years sober. And I thought, I wonder if he'll give me a little time. It's right before Christmas. I called him up and I said, it's right before Christmas. I got the money to make that last payment, but be nice to have it for Christmas. He said, be nice to be alive, too. So I wrote him a check, sent it to him. My wife never got in the way of me making my financial amends. She allowed me to do all that on my own. You betcha. And I took care of those things, went to meetings all the time, had to go to work, whatever. And I was 9, 10 years sober. About 9 or 10, you know, I've had some little milestones in there. You know, 3.5 years sober, almost got drunk trying to figure out St. Francis' prayer. Yeah, you know, and how to pay my credit cards. And 5 years sober, I noticed that there was a lot of people who'd been sober for 5 years weren't there between 5 and 10. And then about 9 years, 7 to 9 years sober, it dawned on me I'm going to have to make amends for the way I'm making amends. I can see it coming. And I've been involved with organized crime for about 20 years. Nothing to do, I didn't bring it in AA or nothing. Just some old lifestyle. And I lived that lifestyle, and I was getting in some trouble, And at about 9 years sober, I got indicted by a federal grand jury, and I sponsored about 63 guys, and every one of them fired me, but one newcomer didn't have sense enough to know what was going on. But I had to pay a lawyer. So all these guys fired me because I couldn't buy ice cream after the meeting, you know. And, the rats leave the ship like a sinking fast, baby. They ask you to do things, especially you walking around with money in your pocket and got a big Rolls Royce to drive around, you know, and all that stuff. Well, better watch that. And, man, they abandoned me. I mean, they took off. And I'll tell you something. There's old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless them. I love the old-timers. And a lot of them have their own way of letting the message come across. But I'll tell you, I'm grateful for the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous that believe that 9 years of sobriety is just as important to save as 9 days. Because we got a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous dying around here with years of sobriety. And people think, well, I'm not going to say nothing because, you know, they're supposed to know. Baloney. 9, 10 years sober, I went through some surrenders. My whole life changed. It has to change or else you get drunk again. And I listened to tapes of people who had gotten drunk and then sobered up again. And I went to people and asked them what to do, and I changed. I had to go get a job with a boss and clock in and clock out. And I had to stand and be accounted for it. I had to go to people that I'd been involved in with years and say, I'm done, I'm through. And you can do that if you stay out of there. See? The problem is people go to those kind of deals and say, I'm done, and then they keep going back. So you got to be done. And I was done. And that lasted a little while, and I'm grateful for those surrenders. I got very active. I've always been very active in jails and institutions, and I'm one of them guys. I never came to AA and became a warden or started my own step house or any kind of thing. I buy my own gas, buy my own insurance on my own car, and pick up my own guys and go to the jail and carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I can do. See, I can't do it no other way. I'm one of them guys. Gets a load of guys in my car that I got insurance on, good tires, good car, and drive 150 miles to a penitentiary, go in that penitentiary, and talk to them guys in there. And I go in there to tell them not what to do to get in there. They already know that. I go in there and tell them what to do to stay out of there. And I make that long drive back home. And I've done that over and over and over and over again for years. And it literally has saved my sanity. It's literally given me a conscience. And I'm grateful for that. I got very involved in convention work and stuff like that because it was apparent to me that a lot of people leave Alcoholics Anonymous because they quit going to AA and what have you, and I didn't want to do that. I go to as many meetings as I did when I was new. I still go to a meeting every day, and I still do the things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I serve, and my home group's over 41 years old. I didn't start it. It's not my meeting. I am just a member of it in good standing. The old-timers are there, baby, and I sit next to them. And, you know, I believe in sponsorship, and I only sponsor men. And my wife is very active in the program of Al-Anon. She's been in here consistently for over 26 years. My daughter's been in the program for over 26 years with no time off for good behavior, no gaps, no, you know, loss of memories. We've been in here in the damn trenches every day, baby, every day. And we've earned what we got. We earned it. Nobody gave us nothing. Nothing. I've always had sponsorship that told me, you get your ass out there and do it and bring it back. And I'm grateful for that. I had hard-hearted sponsors that didn't let me whine. My sponsor today is sober 47 years, and I call him. And he said, remember this. When you're going through hell, don't stop. See? Now, isn't that profound? Yeah. I don't care what other speaker you heard say that. He coined that. He also coined something like, get in the boat. We don't need a captain. Just get an oar and row. See? Things like that. Simple things, see? And I'm grateful for that. And I'll share with you real quickly what Alcoholics Anonymous is to me and what it has been in the very beginning. I'm fortunate in the very beginning, people told me to work with newcomers. I work the steps. I have never balked at the steps. I mean, if you balk at the steps, that's a sign of your intelligence. Because they're not that hard. And what's more, they will set you free. It's the greatest thing ever given to a human being, an opportunity. I've worked them, and I've done them. And I did my fifth step with Chuck Chamberlain because he said, if you do it right, you only have to do it once. And I went to him with that resentment, and he proved it. And I did it with him. And I'm grateful for that. And I let go of things, and I moved on. Which allowed me to immediately start working with newcomers. And I immediately started working with newcomers. that was pushed on me. And I'm grateful that my wife has never resented the method of my recovery. And she's brought a lot of newcomer Al-Anons in her home, and my daughter as well. And I had to learn to treat those ladies with the dignity that they deserve, and not to have those sick ladies over at my house and treat them like they were in a bar room. I learned to do that in there, in my own home, with the newcomers that my wife and daughter brought in there, rather than over at a club or in a meeting even, because part of my amends to my wife was to treat these people with decency and try to do the things that, you know, show the respect. They left the house where there was a drunk asshole like me. I didn't need to treat them like that when they got to my house. My daughter saw me change, and she respected that change. And I was standing around an old meeting hall, Lano Club, and I was sober just a short time. I had many guns on me. If you'd have bumped into me, there'd been a mushroom cloud. And I was just crazy. I owed all these people money. Everything was just nuts. And a weirdo come walking up next to me. My sponsor wouldn't even stand next to me. He'd go and stand in the other corner over there, and he'd get newcomers and say, you know, if you go back out and drink, you'll end up like Keith, see? And I was my group's worst example, and I was doing the best I could. And this weirdo walked up next to me, man, and he had a welder's hat on, pulled down over one ear, and hair sticking out everywhere, and he had a pair of shorts on, had a pair of thongs on, and he painted his feet black with shoe polish like he had socks on, you know. He beat the laundry deal. He came up to me. I'd seen him in a meeting the night before, and he stood up and said if he was the treasurer, and he said, I stole all the money, and I'm not paying it back. And, you know, come up to me and he said, will you be my sponsor? And I thought, oh, I made God real mad somewhere, you know. And I said, just a minute. I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy? And he said, yeah. I said, he just asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor said, yeah, I know. I sent him over there. You go back over there and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly as he says. And that didn't make sense to me, but I didn't want to make my sponsor mad because they just go crazy and embarrass themselves, you know. So I went back over to this guy, and I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? Well, I was sober long enough to get an AA car. You need an AA car. If you want to know what an AA car is, John's got a van out here. That's an AA car, black van with all them things on it. I had a Mark IV Lincoln, had a hood longer than a whore's dream out there. Man, I'm telling you, I parked it right in front of that damn meeting hall, and anybody asked me how am I doing, said, look at my car. Hey, had 104,000 miles on it, but it's slick. Mark IV Lincoln. That guy said, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. I said, all right. We got him in that Lincoln. He started talking to me. He said, how about this? You ever do anything like this? And he started talking this sick stuff, see? He said, you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah. I told him some of my stuff. Took him home, dropped him off, said, I'll be back and get you. Come back and get him. He gets in the car and I said, how about this? And he started telling me some more sick stuff. Now, some of his stuff was so sick, I kind of had to embellish on mine because you can't let them one-up you, you know? I picked him up the next day and he said, I know you lied to me because it's physically impossible to do what you said you did. And I take him to hear Chuck. We sat right on the front row, see? And Chuck's talking about the big book and the carpenter man and all that God stuff. And we go out and get my Lincoln. This guy says, we need a miracle. I said, what? He said, we need a miracle. What are you talking about? And he said, well, parting of the water or something. I'm looking for some lighter fluid. Maybe I can torch a hedge over here or something, you know? But I had a .45 automatic glove box. I got her run around in the chamber and stuck it upside his head. And I said, I'm going to count to 10. You pray. So if I don't have a floating resentment, decide to pop a cap on your ass, you just done step three. Yeah. Oh, he's humming along, you know. I laid the hammer down, put her back in the glove box, you know, and he jumped out of my leg and run right back in there where Rotten Ron was, showed him that ring on the side of his head and said, told Ron, I put that damn gun to the side of his head and made him do step three. And Ron said, yeah, I know, ain't he spiritual? Hey, well, I don't know about you guys. You probably get some real slick people that just want to play golf, but I get assholes to ask me to be their sponsor. People that don't get it no other way unless you hit them with a two before. See? Crazies. You got to be louder than their head. See? And I moved out of the neighborhood, got a nicer house, and this guy showed up at my house, parked his old car up my new driveway. You know you're going up when you go from dirt or blacktop up to a concrete driveway. Now, can't let no oil get on your concrete driveway. And he has stickers all over his car, too. So the neighbors knew, see? And he knocked on the front door. I went over to the front door, and there he was. Looked like half of him stuck in the concrete, and the other half of him was going to Tijuana. Had a big book with paper stuck in it, and I said, what do you want? He said, I want to work the steps like you did. I'm trying to remember how I did them. Well, come on in. I know we're powerless. Our life's unmanageable because you're going to be here a while. You're crazy and I'm crazy. I understand you. You understand me. So we must be on step three again. He said, you're not going to put that gun? I said, no. Go in the kitchen, get on her knees. He cuddled up underneath my arm and I had that tingling sensation. Questioned my sexuality there for a minute. Everybody's hugging around here. The cat walked by and looked at me funny. Anyway, he said he wanted to do a four-step, and he threw a bunch of blank paper in front of me and a pen. He said, I can't write. I'll talk, you write. And he started talking, I started writing. And he said, you ever do anything like that? And I started telling him some of my stuff I remembered. More will be revealed. A couple of things I hadn't told anybody. I knew God had been invited in the room and was. This guy can't read. So I just put some of my stuff in his. What the heck? Hey, God don't care. You're supposed to get it out. You want to carry that load all your life, go ahead. But when God sends a rescue vessel, be sure you put your stuff in it and send it right on down the road. Put it right in there, baby. We burned that when that guy ran out and kissed me on the cheek and went right down the street yelling, I love you, and away he went. Now the neighbors know, you know. I'm going to tell you something. I've been doing that ever since. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. And you've been around here a while and you ain't heard a fifth step. Shame on you. See? I cannot stay in tune with the fact of the consequences of my action if I'm not listening to a newcomer or somebody giving me a fifth step that will tell me that you don't get away with nothing. And as long as I'm listening to them fifth steps, baby, then I'm hearing the consequences of people's actions that are just like me. And that guy sat in my kitchen that day and we talked about his daughters and I talked about my daughters. And we talked about the fact that we were sober adults and that we didn't have to treat our children the way we had when we drank. And we sat there at my kitchen table and cried. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's recovery. I'll tell you a quick God story. Shortly thereafter, I got real busy in convention work. You got chairmen and what have you around here. About 1984, Cease was a banquet speaker. I was the chairman of the convention. Prior to that convention, I was 7 years sober. They have to have all these meetings. And Southern California Convention was 9,000 people. Biggest annual convention, and I knew nothing about that, thank God, and people did that helped me. But you have to have these committee meetings. These committee meetings, they have them every so often once a month prior to the gig. And I went to a committee meeting, and since I was the chairman, I got to open and close and clean up. I had a newcomer with me, and my daughter's with me. She was the Alateen chairman. I was cleaning up the room that this committee had met in. And I saw a man's purse. We had some people from over on the west side coming over. And so they carry men's purses. And I opened it real quick and had money in it. A couple $300, checkbook, credit cards, calendar. And I opened it up and I looked at it. And my first thought was, take the money. Because if you can't take care of your stuff, you don't deserve to have it. You know? But I looked over my shoulder. And that newcomer was watching me and my daughter's watching me. So I saw who it was and I knew who it was. He was on my committee on the entertainment part of it. I went and called him that evening, and I made a trip. And the next Wednesday, I went over on the other side, met him over there at the big meeting in the sky, and gave him his stuff. And this guy was a thespian. He was a model. He was a photographer. Not necessarily somebody I would have drank with at all. He was tickled to death to get his purse back. He looked right to see if the money was there. Took the newcomer with me and my daughter to be sure that we did it. And he said to me, Keith, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I remember thinking, I was sober 7 years, so I didn't have to say nothing smart. But I thought it. There'll never be anything you can do for me, Ace. Just be damn glad you got your purse back. I thought that, but I didn't say it. 4 years later, my daughter had a dream because Alateen taught her to look beyond where others feared to go. She went to Italy to become a model. She couldn't speak Italian. She had no agent. She had a round-trip ticket and $100. She got over there. She got sick. She got holed up in her own motel. And for several weeks, she couldn't get out of there. Didn't know anybody. She finally, because there was no Al-Anon over there, and she was an Al-Anon, she finally got a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous somehow. And because she'd seen the change in me, she believed in Alcoholics Anonymous and nothing. She called Alcoholics Anonymous. It turns out there was a Somebody could speak a little English. They came and got her, took her to a meeting. There were 16 people in the meeting. They went around the room and shared. When they got to her, she said, I know this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an Al-Anon. I really shouldn't be able to share them because they weren't so narrow-minded and they were very hungry. They said, if you'll share a program, we'll let you share. And she shared a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today. And sitting in that meeting was that guy I gave that purse back to. He was over there working as a model. He decided to go, but for some reason, he decided to stay one more week. He says, your dad named Keith? And she said, yes. He said, I owe him a favor. He'd been sober for 4 years, and he still kept that favor, that debt. And he took my daughter, introduced her to people, introduced her to models. She worked, that was 18 years ago. She worked over there in the profession for over 10 years. Very successful model. Met and married an Italian man. Very good man. She got herself spiritually fit to attract a healthy man. That's possible, you know. And she has been instrumental in all kinds of things, helping Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. She started Alateen over there. She started conventions, woman conferences. She was a real pioneer in that thing. And just a couple of weeks ago, I had an opportunity to go over there. And the guy that came and got my daughter has got drunk again, but he's back. And I got to meet him. I got to go to the meetings over there. I got to go and translate. My daughter is very active. Well, she sponsors about 20, 30 young girls over there because there's very little sobriety over there. Lots of drugs, and she sponsors lots of young gals. And my wife and I got to go over there, and we got to be in my daughter's home and be in her family and be with my granddaughter, 4-year-old girl. And I stood in my daughter's house and I looked around. It's a beautiful home. And I stood in my daughter's house and I looked around. There's no holes in the wall. There's no pictures hanging down. See? And I thought, you know, just maybe the chain is broken. If I keep doing these things, just maybe the chain is broken. When my daughter first brought that little girl to America, she flew 16 hours and came to America to bring that little girl. She was 8 months old. And I met her down at LAX, and I'm standing there in LAX with people from all over the world. And my daughter came out of that tunnel and handed me that little baby girl, and her eyes were sparkling, and she was looking at me, and she's laughing. I got tattoos all over me, man. And that little girl's looking at me, and she wasn't afraid of me. And I danced around there like an old fool, and I didn't care who saw. And I think if I keep doing these things, there's absolutely no reason that little girl would ever have to fear me because of you, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, because of loving God, and I do what I'm supposed to do and do the next right thing. I got a chance. God bless and thank you.